Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. There is no man alive, to my way of thinking, who has done more to help chronicle that war, certainly in the recent phases of it, than our first guest. He is Dr. Paul Kengor, a best-selling author, a professor of political science at Grove City College, where he actually heads its Center for Vision and Values. He is the author of more books than we have time to talk about here, though several of them are very relevant to the topic of the day. Paul Kengor, welcome back, I think, for the first time this year. Happy New Year. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Same to you, Frank, and you're way too kind and way too generous in your praises.
Oh, not hardly. I'm only getting warmed up. But listen, Paul, you must have taken considerable satisfaction from the, essentially, I guess, the lifting of the taboo that has been imposed on Barack Obama's personal history and background by Rudy Giuliani, who said what has largely been unsayable in polite society recently, in which he questioned whether the president actually loved America. And I want to talk with you about this partly because of the extraordinarily important work you've done on this subject yourself, notably in The Communist, Frank Marshall Davis, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor, and Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century. What did you make of Rudy's remarks, and to what extent does your personal scholarship on the subject validate that the guy could hardly have a chance of loving America, given the kind of marinating he did in revolutionary, communist, and anti-American stews?
Yeah, well, great question. And by the way, the taboo will be totally lifted when finally somebody in the mainstream media asks Barack Obama about this directly. And you know, that still hasn't happened
yet. I'm not holding my breath.
Right. But Rudy was helping us get closer to it. And I think it was last Saturday, or it was over the weekend, and I got an email from a friend. He said, check out the Drudge Report. And there was a lead there on Rudy pointing to Obama's communist mentor. It was linked to a New York Daily News article. Now, the Daily News is the more liberal of the New York tabloids. And I don't know if you saw this article, Frank, but it was just sort of breathless, this liberal reporter on, how could this possibly be? Where's he coming up with this information, right? And then the next day, Drudge had a New York Post piece where Rudy said, in like one line, he said, look, President Obama was influenced in his youth by a communist named Frank Marshall Davis from the time he was 9 years old. And I thought, wow, you know, way to go, Rudy.
He got a breakthrough, to say the least.
Right, everything.
Yeah. And beyond the Frank Marshall Davis piece, and I do want you to explain a little bit more about that, but talk, if you would, as well about the folks that he went on to be tied to after Frank Marshall Davis that just compounded the problem.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a series of individuals. I mean, Frank Marshall Davis, Bill Ayers, Bernardine Dorn, and, you know, he said
Rashid Khalidi, Jeremiah Wright. I mean,
Wright,
on and on.
Reverend Wright. In fact, the only person, Frank, in Dreams from My Father, who's mentioned more than Frank Marshall Davis is the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And in fact, in Dreams
the
from
man
My
he
Father,
didn't really know so well once the question was put to him about his relationship with him.
That's right. That's right. And remember, too, what I think he told George Stephanopoulos in one of the debates, and Stephanopoulos got just creamed for even bringing this up. But he said, in mentioning Bill Ayers, he said, well, yeah, I was just 8 or 9 years old when Bill Ayers was bombing the Pentagon and attacking New York City and planting bombs and so forth. Well, yeah, but he was 40 years old when in the September 11th, 2001 edition of the New York Times, chillingly, Bill Ayers said in an article that appeared, it was a profile in the New York Times, that he had no regrets for setting any of those explosives. And Obama would have been 34 years old when he met with Bernardine Dorn and Bill Ayers in their living room. He would have been in his mid-30s. He would have been in the Illinois State Senate or about to go in when he was literally serving on boards and working with Bill Ayers.
Right, passing out money for community organizing, as I
recall.
That's
right. They had a working relationship as well as a friendship.
What this really does raise, I guess, for all of us is the question that we sort of started with, and that is, is there an explanation in all of this? The president's background, and we didn't even get into the time he was in an Indonesian madrasa, but
right.
The president's background of anti-Americanism, or at least influences that were rapidly anti-American, and the kinds of policies that we see him pursuing these days, the fundamental transformation of America, notably among them, but also his attitude towards an appeasement of the jihadists. Talk about that, if you would.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, a couple components to it. One, you know, Rudy didn't make this explicit, but Frank Marshall Davis was very anti-American. And you can go to Dreams from My Father for an account of that. The last thing that Barack Obama does before he leaves Hawaii for Occidental College is he pays a visit to Frank Marshall Davis. And Obama there quotes Frank at length, just ripping into the American way. In fact, I checked in my book yesterday because I wanted to see how many references I could find on it. 39 references in my book to Frank Marshall Davis sarcastically referring to the American way. He was very bitter. He didn't like this country. He actually joined the Communist Party under Stalin when the party was pledged to, quote, ensure the triumph of Soviet power in the United States and create a Soviet America.
In other words, the destruction of this country. I mean, let's put a fine point on it. And again, the sort of making common cause that the left has done so much of with these Islamists, Muslim Brotherhood types, many of them, that was sort of evident in his relationship with Rashid Khalidi, as I recall,
right.
a prime apologist for and enabler of Yasser Arafat in this country. But there seem to be so many of these things that keep cropping up. And I just would invite you to talk about net neutrality and the hollowing out of the military and the sort of agenda of diminishing America's standing in the world as he raises up our enemies.
It all goes together, and people will say all the time, okay, so you're saying that Obama was sympathetic to Islam, may have even been a Muslim for a point as a child. So what are you saying now, that five times a day he quietly, privately bows to Mecca? So we had this mentor named Frank Marshall Davis, who's a Communist Party member. So are you saying that he's a closet card-carrying member of Communist Party USA? No, the left always does this. They'll take it and they'll caricature it. No, what we are saying is that all of this stuff, when you add it together, helps explain why we have this man who's so far to the left. It all goes together. All of this stuff in the background, these are all key formative, ideological, even religious influences in the man who's now sitting in the White House.
Yeah. And Paul Kanger, the point is that it's not just, you know, where he sits politically or physically, for that matter, but it's what the policies are that he's pursuing. And that's really where we focus on it, of course, so heavily here is on the national security piece. And speaking of which, I just want to draw you out because you have done, among other things, we've talked about the communists, we've talked about dupes, but two other extraordinarily important of your books, The Judge, William P. Clark, Ronald Reagan's Top Hand, and a personal favorite of mine, The Crusader, about President Reagan's program for victory over Soviet communism. We have at the Center for Security Policy, in a kind of homage to President Reagan's National Security Decision Directive 75, dusted it off and said, hey, here's a good workable strategy for defeating a totalitarian ideology trying to destroy us. I know you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but I would be very interested in your thoughts about the advisability of sort of adapting NSDD 75 to the present era. Paul Kinger.
Yeah, I think this is great, Frank. This is the kind of really innovative stuff that you and you guys do at the Center for Security Policy. But the NSDD 75 came out January 17, 1983. It was shepherded by Bill Clark at Reagan's National Security Council, and Richard Pipes, the great Harvard professor of Russian history, he helped write it in those first couple years of the Reagan NSC. And what this did was this laid out a grand strategy, a plan for taking down and defeating the primary international enemy at the time, which was Soviet communism. And we are completely lacking anything like that today. So I love this concept.
This is where we hope to come in. Paul Kenger, this is a subject for a much longer conversation. I look forward to having it with you very soon. Thank you for this extraordinary corpus of biographies and analyses and histories that make, I know, your teaching at Grove City College of such inestimable importance to your students and frankly, for the rest of us as well. We'll look forward to a further chat soon. Next up, Peter Brooks joins us from the Heritage Foundation about why Obama's telegraphing a punch at Mosul. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states. One that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by a friend and colleague of many years, Dr. Peter Brooks. He is a man who has distinguished himself in a number of different capacities, both in uniform as a decorated Navy veteran and in the intelligence community, and in, not least, the Department of Defense Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary with responsibility for the Asia and Pacific portfolio. We'll talk about all of that with him. But his broader portfolio these days is as a senior fellow for National Security Affairs at Heritage Foundation's Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute. Peter, good to have you with us as always. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
You have written recently about something that I must say was sort of jaw-dropping to me, and I think to most of us as well, which was, well, kind of a telegraphed punch, if ever there were one, by the Obama administration about an upcoming offensive against the Islamic State to recapture the city of Mosul. What's up with that? What did you make of it? And what do you think the president would let the kind of information out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a head-scratcher, isn't it? I remember seeing it, and it came right on the heels of their conference on combating violent extremism, which I think came off as kind of academic and a bit soft, and all of a sudden CENTCOM had announced via the Pentagon to some reporters that they were going to gave the outlines of an offensive into Mosul this spring. I mean, you know, it's like, hey, ISIS, please save the date. You know, with my military background, and I was just like, my jaw hit the desk. I just couldn't believe it. So I felt like I needed to write something about it. I had to scratch my head a little bit and figure out what might have been behind it. And I really couldn't find anything that was satisfying to me other than perhaps it's some sort of terrific psychological operation and we actually were going to hit them tomorrow instead of in a couple of weeks. But, you know, the idea is the Iraqi army going to be ready? You know, the Iraqi defense minister came out and said, what are the Americans doing talking about this? I mean, I saw this in a foreign news service. And even the Kurds, and you know, they're unhappy because the Kurds are unhappy because they don't have the weapons. They're good fighters in the Peshmerga. The Iraqis are in training.
We're joined by Peter Brooks of the Heritage Foundation. He is the author of A Devil's Triangle: Terrorism, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and Rogue States. He served in the senior ranks of the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, including as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Affairs. And Peter, you were just making the very compelling point that this pronouncement, this leak of some rather detailed information, it sounds like, of an operational kind, clearly caught some of those that were counting on to actually do the offensive by surprise, and I'm sure their jaws were hitting the deck as well. What is this likely to do to morale for those who we are going to be throwing into, presumably, if it does come to pass, a better defended, better prepared, and much more deadly vortex in Mosul as a result?
Yeah, I mean, and maybe it's a feint. That's the only thing I can think. You know, hey, we're coming to Mosul, and we're not going to Mosul, and we're going to swing into Anbar.
Pas de Calais trick, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm not against that sort of thing, but I'm worried because the strategy up to this point with Iraq and Syria and ISIS has been so bad, I don't believe they could pull that off. So, you know, that's my concern. In fact, yesterday I was called by CNN to talk about, you know, that they were hearing that it's possible that they might decide to go into Anbar first. And I said, yeah, that kind of makes sense to me. How about, you know, getting some victories under the Iraqi, you know, army's belt? Remember, this is where we had that terrible thing last summer where they were fleeing ISIS and stripping off their uniforms and dropping their weapons. I mean, you know, do you want to really start with Iraq's second biggest city? I mean, this is one of the crowns in the jewel. I mean, jewels in the crown when you talk about, you know, Baghdad and Mosul in terms of city size. 2 million people, you know, urban warfare, street-to-street fighting, clearing homes, you know, lots of civilians.
Yeah, all of that. And they're talking about 25,000 Iraqi troops. Let's hope that they are better equipped, better trained, better led than they were the last time around. But
and they can win something. That's what I'm really worried about. Think about the psychological situation where they go in there and it turns into a quagmire, it goes badly, and then, you know, ISIS, you know, holds the city. But, you know, and the other so I think they're thinking this again. So I think this was really meant to be a public relations stand. It was political. In other words, the conference came came off. You know, the president was under fire about Islamic and Islamists. You know, it sounded very, you know, talk shoppy, you know, lots of jobs for jihadists, as I call it, education for extremists.
Well, it didn't sound serious. It sounded as though they were airbrushing out the problem. So that you think they needed to have something to demonstrate their macho.
Yeah, muscle up the message, I think, is what they did. But, I mean, it was just bad form. I mean, you know, from a security standpoint, I mean, I can't tell you how many emails I got from old Navy friends talking about whatever happened to operational security.
At best, it's incredible. And at worst, it's a serious breach of security for people who are going to be put into very serious harm's way.
Which could include some of our forces that may end up in some way, you know, standing side by side and putting a little spine into the Iraqi army.
Indeed, or providing support of other kinds. Peter, which raises a sort of larger question. Again, our guest is Peter Brooks of the Heritage Foundation. He's written an important book on the subject, A Devil's Triangle, Terrorism, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and Rogue States. What do you recommend at this point the Congress do with this so-called authorization of the use of military force, focused rather narrowly and for a short period of time and with considerable, you know, restraint on the Islamic State?
You know, I'm not a lawyer. I've been accused of being lawyerly, but I'm not a lawyer. And so, Frank, I, you know, in terms of that, but from my perspective as a, you know, a John Q. public national security type, I don't think they need another one. I think it's all covered here, and I think the president is looking for political cover. You know, we often joke in Washington that, you know, that politics is the art of transferring blame. And I think the president is asking the Congress to go on the record with him that he, what he's doing is okay. So I don't know if we really need it. You know, of course, it has to go through congressional, you know, machinations in terms of that. People are saying, you know, does it limit us too much? Is it too open? You know, and I think it's good that Congress, you know, will certainly debate this. But what I'm worried about is the strategy on the ground. I mean, we're involved in a war right now. I mean, this is just, in my sense, you know, like I said, I'm not a lawyer. I understand the importance of doing things legally. But, you know, my concern is that we've got, you know, F-18 pilots dropping metal and bombs in, you know, in Iraq and Syria. We've got real fighting going on. You see the daily atrocities we're seeing out of this group. You know, that Libya, you know, the fact that ISIS is in Libya now. In fact, I wrote a column last week for the Boston Herald talking about how all these other, where ISIS flags are being planted elsewhere, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, Yemen, including the Philippines.
Yeah, it's a global jihad is the point.
Yeah, I mean we're involved in the war here, so I don't want to get too caught up in the paperwork. I want to get the job done and get it done right, and you know, put these guys out of business.
I couldn't agree more. One of the reasons I ask, I guess, Peter, is, as you may or may not know, we've put together a strategy for doing that at the Center for Security Policy, and I commend it to you. We were just talking about it with our previous guest, Paul Kenger, but it's rooted in something that I think you'll remember, too, the Reagan strategy for trying to defeat a global threat animated by a totalitarian ideology that sought our destruction. And it seems to me that that's a better way to proceed than this kind of half-baked, you know, incoherent and certainly poorly executed program, not by the military per se, but by its political masters. You've served among them and have some very important insights into how this works and how it doesn't work, Peter Brooks, and we appreciate always your coming by to help expose the rest of us to what's actually going on and what needs to be. And I hope in the future we can bring you back to talk a bit more about China, of which you have considerable expertise and where there's also some very looming dangers. But in the meantime, thanks for all you're doing at the Heritage Foundation. Peter, keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, Congressman Mike Pompeo joins us. We'll talk with him about this Kerry pronouncement that Americans are more safe than ever. Trust me. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn.
Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama has acted unconstitutionally in extending amnesty to millions of illegal aliens. To his credit, Speaker John Boehner has responded appropriately thus far, leading his caucus and chamber to exercise the power of the purse, eliminating all funding for Team Obama's serial unconstitutional actions. Unfortunately, his Senate counterpart, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, has decided to throw in the towel on such a principled response to presidential lawlessness. Senator McConnell's effective collapse on a funding cutoff for amnesty simply rewards Obama's misconduct. All the more reason why Leader McConnell must now block the nomination of Loretta Lynch as the next Attorney General. We don't need and can't afford a justice, someone like Eric Holder, who enables this president's faithless execution of his sworn duty to protect and defend the Constitution. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm thrilled to say we are joined by one of the members of Congress who I admire most. He is Representative Mike Pompeo, a member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and also the Select Committee on Benghazi. His other main committee is on energy and commerce, and he serves on a number of subcommittees of great interest to us with respect to, among other things, the infrastructure that produces our energy and thereby keeps everything else going. He is a graduate of West Point, in fact, first in his class at West Point, a man who has served in uniform in the 2nd Squadron of the 7th Cavalry of the 4th Infantry Division, and among other capacities. He is today representing with great distinction the people of the 4th District of Kansas and is always welcome. Congressman, thank you again for joining us.
Frank, it's great to be with you today.
I wanted to get your reaction first and foremost to a comment that the Secretary of State made yesterday, I believe up on Capitol Hill, to the effect that, you know, Americans are really safer today than they have been in a long time, notwithstanding the sort of troubling evidence to the contrary. It was kind of like that old Groucho Marx line, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? You know, what did you make of that statement?
Frank, that statement is so disconnected from reality that it is difficult to imagine that a senior American official could ever make such a comment. The data simply refutes it in every material respect, and common sense would tell you that the world is a far riskier place today than it was a year ago or 2 years ago or 6 years ago. The threats have multiplied,
and our resistance to those threats has been not quite, but nearly the null set. The bad guys know it, and they continue to expand to fill this vacuum.
Yeah. You participated very helpfully, I think, in a summit that we convened at the Center for Security Policy, up at the Reserve Officers Association, I should say, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, and made the point there, among other things, that unfortunately this kind of, well, willful blindness is perhaps a charitable way of describing it, is actually emboldening our enemies, not just making us less safe because they're abroad in the land, as it were, but actually incentivized to redouble their efforts against us if they think what we're doing in response is weakness. Is that a fair characterization of your thinking?
It is. I enjoyed being there. I enjoyed being around a group of people who were prepared to talk about radical Islam in the way that it needs to be talked about. The president held something a couple weeks later called this a violent extremism summit. But what they did was the bad guys were watching that too, and the bad guys watched that and said, oh, goodness gracious, the president doesn't understand what we're really doing, right? He doesn't understand that we're driven by an ideology, a commitment to Islam that is violent and is prepared to go expand the caliphate. The president doesn't get that. We have the license to move about the cabin quickly, vigorously, and with force, and we'll meet little or no resistance. It is dangerous to talk about this in the way that the president and Senator Kerry did yesterday, and we all have an obligation to make sure the American people understand that there are folks out there who are prepared to take them on.
You know, Congressman Mike Pompeo, that's, again, perhaps a very charitable interpretation of this. I wonder whether, in fact, what the president is conveying to them is not simply that he doesn't understand, but that there's really kind of an affinity for, if not the violent beheading and crucifixions and, you know, slaying of Christians and all that, but at least for the cause in which these guys are engaged in such activities, the raising up of the Muslim Ummah, shall we say, the nation, and, you know, sort of a grand rebalancing of America's role in the world, which has been too powerful and too oppressive in favor of, you know, helping the downtrodden, the people who need jobs and that sort of thing to find their way. I mean, you're watching this very closely, of course, from your vantage point on the Intelligence Committee. Could that possibly be a takeaway for bad guys who hear him saying nothing about their ideological agenda?
Frank, every place you stare at the president's policies and statements, you see what you just described. So the Egyptians bomb terrorists in eastern Libya, and the administration says, gosh, we can't support that. The Egyptians, under their leader al-Sisi, begin to push back inside the ideology of the faith, and our president refuses to talk about it that way. Today, Americans are sitting at a table with the Iranians, the largest state sponsor of terror in the world, treating them as if they're a negotiating partner. Every policy of this administration has treated America as if we are the problem and not the solution to keeping not only America safe, but a stable world.
You have raised an alarm particularly about the president's determination, Congressman Pompeo, to close down Guantanamo Bay, and notably pointed out that the recidivism, which has been such a problem with the people we've let out of there, is continuing, including with his Taliban gang that he released in exchange for a man who evidently is going to be recognized for what he was, a deserter. Talk about that piece of this failed policy. And again, I'm minded of the fact that we're endlessly told Gitmo is a recruiting tool. I can't imagine that closing Gitmo wouldn't be considered to be such a signal victory for our enemies that it would be an even bigger recruiting tool.
Look, it's proven to be an important intelligence collection tool, right? It gives America the option not just to drop a missile on someone's head, but rather to capture them, bring this enemy combatant to a place where we can go get the information so we can take down these terrorist networks. Why a president would be so intent on listening to his lefty base about closing a facility that has been such an important American asset for an awfully long time is beyond me. We've managed to keep it open against the president's wishes for the first 6 years and 2 months, and we're going to work really hard to make sure the last 22 months of his administration leave this tool in place for an ex-president who is serious about defeating radical Islam.
Well, we need to say support you in that, Congressman, and wish you well, and anything that we can do to assist in making the case that this is really, as you say, a critical asset. especially if we're serious about waging war against these guys, which our secure freedom strategy suggests we better be. And you're so right about the importance of having human intelligence in the mix. And this is a great resource for that if we're willing to use it as such. Congressman, let me turn to one other problem that I know has come to your attention as a member of the Intelligence Committee. A lack of clarity about the nature of the enemy has been particularly evident, it seems to me, as it relates to the president's view, the administration's attitude and conduct with respect to the Muslim Brotherhood. And I ask this in particular because the threat here at home is within the purview of your intelligence oversight responsibilities, of course. And therefore, it's all the more worrying that Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, has recently appointed as a member of the Democratic membership of that important House Intelligence Panel, Andre Carson from Indiana, who has, as we've documented in an extensive dossier, very, very long-standing and apparently deep personal ties to Muslim Brotherhood operatives and organizations. Should that not be of concern to us?
Frank, yesterday, director of the FBI Comey made a statement that there are investigations being conducted in every single one of the 50 states of the United States of America of homegrown violent extremists. Now, I would characterize it differently, but what he really meant to say was there are organizations and networks here in the United States tied to radical Islam in deep and fundamental ways, and they're not just in places like Libya and Syria and Iraq, but in places like Coldwater, Kansas, and small towns all throughout America. This network is real. The efforts to expand the caliphate are not limited to the physical geography of the Middle East or in other places where there are large Muslim majorities, and we should be concerned that every member of Congress understands that in the same way, such that we can go ahead and do the things we need to do to keep us all safe. And so I'm always concerned when there's risk, counterintelligence risk, risk of influence that can take place. And so we all, as members of Congress who have a constitutional obligation, have a duty to make sure that we all live to that standard.
Well, amen to that. I would just simply say, in addition to the violent extremism, as they keep insisting on calling it, there is this stealthy civilization jihad of the Muslim Brotherhood, which includes penetration and subversion and, well, as they call it, destroying us from within by our own hands. I appreciate tremendously your service, Congressman Mike Pompeo, on the Intelligence Committee and in the Congress more generally, and your willingness to talk with us from time to time. I hope we'll have a chance to do so again soon. In the meantime, keep up the great work and your leadership, especially on these matters of the Islamic and jihadist threat. Next up, we'll be speaking with Fred Flights, a former longtime member of the Intelligence Committee staff, on Carson matter and straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We will never fully understand what we've asked of our military service members, of their families, or their children, asking them to deploy, patrol, stay on watch, on point, asking them to put themselves in harm's way, to endure it all. But we do understand that it's our turn, our duty, to bring them all the way home, to keep them secure, to have their backs for the rest of their lives. Wounded Warrior Project long-term support programs do whatever it takes to help our most severely ill or injured veterans live independently at no cost for life, so that they might stand at ease. Find out how you can help at findwwp.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm a firefighter.
A teacher.
I'm a farmer.
I'm a barber.
A waitress.
A mom.
We're all part of your community. Every day we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life. It's when you experience a moment of uncertainty, something or someone's behavior that doesn't seem quite right.
These are the moments to take a pause.
Because if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not. It's not about paranoia
or being afraid.
It's about standing up and protecting our communities.
One detail at a time.
Because a lot of little details can become a pattern.
We
trust our instincts.
Just like you should.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Flights, a senior and highly skilled intelligence professional, now I'm very pleased to say a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. Fred Flights is our go-to guy on matters involving so many of these intelligence issues and national security more broadly, not least because of his 20 years' experience in the Central Intelligence Agency analyzing such issues, his role as the chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton in the State Department, and as a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee, a subject that we'll come back to in a moment. But Fred, let me start with something you've spent basically your entire professional life on, and that is the Iranian regime's ambitions to obtain nuclear weapons and their relentless pursuit of those ambitions and apparently the President of the United States' acquiescence now to their realization.
good to be here, Frank. Well, there have been some new developments, some new revelations about the Obama administration's policy on the Iranian nuclear program, and I've been calling it a nuclear sellout. We learned recently that the Obama administration has essentially confirmed that the deal that they're going to strike with Iran will only last about 10 years. But new details have been leaked that if Iran behaves itself, it will be allowed to ramp up its uranium enrichment before that 10-year window is up. Iran will be allowed to operate 6,500 uranium centrifuges. And according to Washington Post columnist David Ignatius, who is frankly a blatant apologist for the Obama administration, advanced centrifuges will only be unplugged. They won't be destroyed. And even more stunning than all of this, there's a reactor called the Arak Heavy Water Reactor. We've been calling for years to shut this down because when it's completed, it will be a source of plutonium. The Iranians will be allowed to continue to build this reactor without any alterations, according to Ignatius. However, they'll have to stop working on it just before it becomes operational. I don't understand this, Frank. Plutonium is a bad thing for Iran to have because it is the best nuclear fuel because it's lighter. It's important for missile warheads. So why are we proposing to let Iran to have a reactor that will produce plutonium?
Yeah. And Fred, you hit two things there that are very troubling. The whole point of this exercise, as I understood it, once the administration abandoned the idea that it was actually putting the Iranian nuclear weapons program out of business, which it did, I think, fairly early on, was to assure that there was a protracted period of time before any decision to actually obtain those nuclear weapons, as though that hasn't already been made, but some prospective decision translates into actually having the wherewithal to do it, would be very long. Doesn't sound like it'd be very long to re-plug in a centrifuge or very long to get them, you know, generating enough material if they're all in place or to turn on the Arak reactor if it's almost complete and only at that point is it forced to go into a pause. Is this, in fact, really, Fred Flights, not pretty much a complete collapse of the American position?
It really is, and I want to mention two points really quickly. First of all, the Obama administration is trying to claim they want to keep Iran a year away from making nuclear weapons. Iran is already about 3 months away, and we have proven this on securefreedom.org. We have analysis of how close Iran is. But, Frank, I want to mention something that you mention every time I get into this, and I always forget to mention, and that is secret facilities. The NCRI, an Iranian dissident group, came out with a damning report this week that there's a secret facility called Lavazan 3 where Iran may be covertly preparing advanced centrifuges and enriched uranium. I mean, this could be a deal breaker. As bad as this deal is, I can't see how we can go forward with this deal if Iran has a massive facility where they're enriching uranium. And as you've often said, the big problem is what we don't know. And I think this is a big example of what we don't know.
Well, we had a marvelous truth squad that we served up on Capitol Hill a couple of weeks ago. You were part of that, Fred Flights. And I, as you say, I made that point on that occasion, not having this information in hand, but strongly suspecting, given what the Iranians have done and given that everything else that we've found out about their Iranian program has basically been as a result of people, you know, bringing into the light what was being secretly pursued by them at that time. So it just stood to reason. But you're right. This adds, you know, a whole new level of fraud to the idea that we're actually doing something meaningful here other than essentially legitimating the Iranian regime as a nuclear weapon state. And whether it's plutonium or highly enriched uranium, it's going to be a very bad thing for the world if that happens. Which brings me to a warning that is widely expected to be sounded on this issue by Benjamin Netanyahu, the elected prime minister of one of our most important allies in the world. Fred, you've spent time on Capitol Hill. Of course, you've spent time in Foggy Bottom. You've been in the Washington power business for many years. What do you make of the way the Obama administration is treating this important ally to the point where Susan Rice is saying the fact of this speech is destructive of the relationship, for God's sake?
It's appalling to see the Obama administration treating the head of one of our closest friends far worse than it criticizes the leadership of Iran. Protocol is broken here. There's no doubt that the heads of state are supposed to go through the White House. But the president has dissed the prime minister of Israel so badly and has misled the American people in Israel to such an extent about the Iranian talks, I believe Netanyahu had no choice but to come here and to speak plainly about the enormous risks from these flawed nuclear talks. And I'm glad he's coming.
Yeah. Well, I'm told actually from even the protocol point of view that the White House was notified, but they clearly don't want him to make this speech. But what I have to say, Fred, just galls me up beyond words, is that at the very moment that they're professing that this is really all about not wanting to somehow interfere with the Israeli elections, namely, don't let him come and lest it somehow redound to his benefit in the elections in Israel, they're actively trying to subvert the guy with political cronies of the president in Israel as we speak. Let me turn to one last thing, Fred, because, again, you've spent time on the Intelligence Committee in the House of Representatives. I'd like your thoughts on the appointment to that committee of Representative Andre Carson, a Democrat of Indiana, by Nancy Pelosi. In light of information that we've developed at the Center for Security Policy, all, by the way, from open sources, about Andre Carson's rather dubious associations with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, let me say there's nothing wrong with Muslims serving on the House Intelligence Committee. And that's the position, my position. I know it's a position of the center. I was on the committee with Muslim staffers. They were loyal Americans. I learned a lot from them. That's not why I'm against Carson being on this committee. This is a select committee, which means the top House leaders choose the members based on whether they are best suited to be on the Intelligence Committee. Now, Mr. Carson has enormous connections with the Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations who either look the other way or endorse violence, violent jihad and Sharia. This person is clearly not the best qualified to be chosen by Pelosi to be on this committee. There's people who have been excluded from this committee because they were decided that they weren't competent enough or they may be security risks. What's the justification for putting someone who has affiliated himself with so many Muslim Brotherhood and pro-Hamas organizations on the most sensitive committee in the U.S. Congress? I can't figure it out.
Well, I can't either, especially since one of the functions of that committee, as you know so well, is not only to oversee the collection and operations of the U.S. intelligence community overseas, but also the domestic efforts being made by the FBI to protect us against enemies within, and the people that Andre Carson is associated with, and it's not just recently, this is going back years, are leaders and front groups of the First Order tied to the Muslim Brotherhood by the federal government itself in many cases. And that just raises a question to my mind as to whether this guy either has the judgment to be on that committee or may not also have serious compromises that should preclude his participation in its deliberations. Fred, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I thank you, as always, for your past service to our country and that you're rendering now as a senior fellow at our Center for Security Policy. Keep it up. Come back to us soon. We'll come back, I hope, with the rest of you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.